Ending excessive incarceration. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Conversation. I'm David Schuster. There is a growing bipartisan effort to try to come up with some common sense solutions to try to remove nonviolent offenders from essentially being stuck in the US criminal justice system. The effort is being led by a group called Reform Alliance. Its CEO, OO, and chief advocacy officer joins us today, Jessica Jackson. She's also a former mayor of Mill Valley, California. Jessica, this is personal to you. Explain why.
Yes, thanks for having me on. So this is personal to me because like so many Americans out there, I had a loved one who was incarcerated. The more I've gotten to see the problems in our justice system, the more I've just met so many families that like mine were torn apart by a criminal legal system that fails to make us safer and instead just tears families apart.
What were some of the things you saw in your particular case?
So here at Reform Alliance, we're really focused on supervision, so probation and parole reforms. We see so many cases that are just heartbreaking and serve no interest in public safety. Like one man we saw down in Pennsylvania who unfortunately was hit by a drunk driver while he was on probation. He was in the hospital, he was in a coma, he was unable to report to his probation officer, so he missed their weekly meetings. As a result, his probation was violated and he had to face the very real possibility of going back to prison because he had been unable to make those meetings. We've seen, you know, people who have been incarcerated for missing meetings with probation officers, who've been incarcerated for simply being in the presence of somebody else, a loved one who had a felony as well, people who have left the county to visit a dying grandmother and come home and found out that they were now on their way to having their probation revoked, unfortunately, because they had left the county's jurisdiction. So just so many heartbreaking examples of a system that fails to value any human dignity and also fails to make us safer.
And it seems like the parole and probation system itself is complicated. I mean, even for those of us who are not part of it, but trying to understand what are the rules and what are not the rules and when are there exceptions, it seems very complex. And you would think that, well, there should be an answer for all this. It should be sort of streamlined, it should be more simple. What's the political will out there, both at the state level, maybe the federal level, to try to change this?
Well, I think there's great news on that front. So probation was started as a way to help people stabilize who are, you know, they've just been convicted of a crime, either they've served some time in prison or jail, or you know, they've been allowed to remain in the community. But it was meant to focus to help stabilize people. What it's evolved into is really a trapdoor to failure, where people are being incarcerated for these technical violations I spoke of, or being incarcerated, you know, for failing to comply with a simple condition of their with a not so simple condition of their probation or parole. What's great about this issue is it's one that has really transcended all the political disruption that's out there. We've been able to pass 16 bills in 10 different states over the course of the last 3 years, introducing probation and parole reforms in red, blue, purple states. We've been able to build some incredible coalitions with both conservative and liberal partners, and have been able to work with business leaders, faith leaders, local elected officials, folks who realize that these are evidence-based solutions that are going to make their community safer.
What has been the single most effective argument? I mean, I've heard a lot of people say, look, it's just a waste of taxpayer money to take people who are nonviolent offenders because they break parole or probation, to send them back to prison where the taxpayers have to essentially warehouse them again. Is that the leading argument? Are there other arguments that seem to cut through?
Yeah, I think it depends who you're speaking to, right? Sometimes it's the audience that one particular message might pertain to. But across the board, you know, people are worried about taxpayer resources. They're worried about their community safety. They don't want to see a whole bunch of money being sunk into something that is not effective in keeping them safe. They'd rather see it go to address the underlying reason why people are committing crimes, whether that's substance abuse or poverty or mental health reasons. And I think the human dignity angle, there are just so many stories out there, and reform has been working to highlight them, working to elevate the voices of people who have been impacted, as well as their families and their children, and really get those stories out there so that people connect with this on a human level.
You mentioned the children and the sort of the human connection in all of this. What sort of impact does it have on children when they're a parent or a loved one is locked away for a period of time?
I mean, it's a huge impact. Imagine not having your mom or your dad there to kiss you goodnight as you're going to bed, or not having them there to pick you up from school. Unfortunately, about 7% of the children in America are going through that. They have had a family member, a parent who's been incarcerated. You've got millions, 35 million kids who have a parent who has a criminal record. This can lead to extreme collateral consequences. People who have a hard time finding a job because of that conviction many years ago. People who have a hard time finding housing because of that conviction many years ago. People who can't attend a school field trip with their child because of a, you know, conviction years and years ago. So it has a huge detrimental impact on kids. In fact, kids are much more likely to enter the system themselves when they grow up. So we start seeing generational incarceration. And all that could be avoided because, unfortunately, like I said, it comes with a very high cost, not just in human dignity and taxpayer resources, but to public safety, because just locking people up and throwing away the key for a set period of time and then releasing them with no job, no housing, no support doesn't actually make us any safer.
You've been on the front lines of some of these legislative efforts, most notably perhaps the 2018 First Step Act, which was perhaps one of the biggest criminal justice reform bills passed in a long time. What is the key, whether it's at the state or the federal level, in terms of getting the legislation through, connecting with lawmakers and getting them to say, hey, this is something we need to do?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, the formerly incarcerated or formerly supervised community is essential. Being able to elevate their voices, get those stories out there, they're just so heartbreaking. And they really open up legislators' hearts to what's going on. I think second are bipartisan coalitions. It's just key. You see, we've worked on reforms across multiple administrations, both state and federal level, even local reforms. And the key to doing so is to pull together a big group of bipartisan members and unlikely stakeholders like the business community, and have everybody pushing for the reforms. So we've had huge success in a time when politics are very, very difficult, as we're seeing, you know, even as recent as with the House Speaker fight. But we've been able to get some real reforms done and change some real lives.
And I understand it's not just, of course, about legislation and whatnot. The Reform Alliance has had some events for kids, I noticed, just one in Philadelphia with sponsorships from professional sports teams.
Yeah, that's absolutely one of my favorite parts of the year, is getting to meet with the kids. I was part of the Brooklyn Nets event that happened with our board member Clara Wusai and board member Meek Mill, as well as Lala Anthony, who came out. It was a bunch of about 21 moms and their kids. All the moms had been justice impacted, had been incarcerated. And it just was so great to watch these kids. You know, they came running through the gift store and they were picking out jerseys and putting their own names on the jerseys. They were watching the players practice. They, you know, got to go down and sit by the court, and then they got to watch the game and have a dinner and meet Meek and meet Michael Rubin and meet Clara Wusai. So it's really one of the most special parts of what we do.
And these are families that I would imagine have been through the ringer, who have been through a lot of heartache. And so to have something so positive and essentially maybe takes away part of the stigma that maybe they had been feeling.
Absolutely. And I think it gives them a reason to be hopeful, especially around the holidays. It puts a smile on their face.
For people who want to help out on their own, just, you know, concerned community members, citizens who feel like, yeah, we need to do something about excessive incarceration. We need to figure out how to change and simplify probation and make exceptions for people who, you know, have to be in the hospital or visit a sick relative. What can they do?
Yeah, so first and foremost, you need to follow Reform Alliance on social media. You need to go to reformalliance.com and sign up to be a reformer so you can keep in touch with our efforts and help us change these laws. Second, you know, if you work at a company, talk to them about hiring practices. Hiring people who are formerly incarcerated is something that all of us can help affect, and it really truly changes lives. We just recently had a job fair for a bunch of folks who are on parole here in New York. It was absolutely incredible. And I'll tell you afterwards, when I talked to some of the employers who hired them, they say they're the best employees that they have. So that's another area that people can have a huge impact.
And in terms of legislation and legislative fights, is there one particular that's coming up, one particular state battle or federal battle that you're looking at right now?
Yes, and if people sign up to become a Reform Alliance reformer, they'll be able to help us sign petitions, write to your legislators. We've got several new bills this year out in the states, including ones in Iowa and Pennsylvania and Indiana. We're also going to be working on a federal bill, and we're just super excited to be continuing our efforts and broadening the number of lives that we're able to touch.
Yeah, and there are both conservative and progressive arguments to get behind this and not only reform the criminal justice system, but make it perhaps a little easier so that there are some common sense reforms for people who accidentally violate parole or probation. Jessica Jackson, she's with the Reform Alliance. Jessica, thanks so much for doing this. We appreciate it, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
You got it. Welcome back to the conversation. I'm David Schuster. The US Supreme Court has now set a hearing date for President Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness case. Here to talk about that and what it all means is Ayelet Sheffy. She's a senior economic policy reporter for Insider. Ayelet, February 28th, that's when they're going to have the arguments. Explain what the legal issues are in front of the court.
Yeah, absolutely. So on February 28th, we have two lawsuits that will be coming to the Supreme Court. And these are the two lawsuits that late last year succeeded in blocking Biden's federal student loan forgiveness. So one of the lawsuits was filed by six Republican-led states who sued Biden's federal student debt relief because they argued that it would hurt their state's tax revenues and that of student loan company Mohila, which is based in Missouri, excuse me, where the lawsuit was based. And then we have another lawsuit that was brought on by two student loan borrowers, one who sued because they did not qualify for the full $20,000 amount of student debt relief. And this is the overarching theme that the Supreme Court will take on when they hear these cases in early February and will ultimately decide, you know, if the student debt relief can go through.
And to remind everybody, the student loan forgiveness that Joe Biden came up with, it's a $20,000 in forgiveness for people, who are making less than $125,000 a year. The president could have gone much higher. He could have set the threshold for income lower or higher. And so part of what I understand is that Joe Biden, when he enacted this, he used a 2003 HEROES Act, which had a provision within the education bill, which said that in case of national emergency, the Department of Education could forgive student loans. And the Biden administration said, aha, the pandemic, that's all the justification we need. Is there another route if the Supreme Court were to say, no, you can't do that, that was arbitrary and capricious as the law says, the education secretary can't do that. Can they use something like the 1965 education bill to justify student loan forgiveness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think a lot of Democratic lawmakers and advocates have been arguing that since the HEROES Act of 2003 is reliant on a national emergency like the pandemic, and it risks getting struck down by the Supreme Court, given that's what, you know, a lot of critics have been saying, he can't keep using the pandemic as a reason to cancel the student debt. The Higher Education Act of 1965 would actually give the education secretary the ability to waive or modify student loan balances without, you know, being connected with a national emergency like COVID-19. The administration has not commented on whether it would pursue that route, but it's certainly something that a lot of you know, legal experts, advocates, and Democratic lawmakers like Elizabeth Warren have been arguing that he could have done that from the start and possibly avoided these legal challenges.
What are legal experts saying in terms of where this seems to be headed? I mean, does it seem like there are the votes in the court on both wings of the Supreme Court to support this kind of authority within the executive branch to essentially forgive student loans, or are there some fears that maybe the votes are not there?
Yeah, I think that's certainly something that's on a lot of people's minds right now. what we've seen, you know, obviously the Supreme Court is conservative majority, and they do tend to uphold what the lower court's rulings have been. And given that these lawsuits have been blocked in conservative majority courts, appointed by former President Donald Trump and Bush, I believe as well, people are thinking that if they go with the precedent and they stick with those lower court rulings, they might ultimately decide that the student debt relief is illegal. But obviously, we have yet to hear the argument, so we'll just have to see how that progresses.
And for students, there's been a lot of confusion for people who are looking at their debt, who think, okay, I qualify, and how come I haven't been able to get my debt forgiven? What do they do right now? I assume they're just sort of treading water and hoping. If you're a student, you hope that the Supreme Court upholds the Biden administration, and then at some point, maybe later in the year, maybe the summertime, then they get their student loan forgiven.
Yeah, so at this point, there is a ton of uncertainty as we're going into this new year as to where borrowers' balances will end up standing. The one thing we do know right now is that payments were supposed to resume on January 1st, just a couple of days ago, but Biden did extend that student loan payment pause 60 days after June 30th or whenever the lawsuits are resolved. So the latest borrowers will probably start resuming their payments this year would be in September. But obviously, we don't know how these lawsuits will play out, what course they will take. So it is dependent on those. Other things borrowers can be doing right now is monitoring the reforms to targeted student loan forgiveness programs like public service loan forgiveness, closed school discharges and total and permanent disability discharges. The administration has implemented some reforms that they've started to carry out and they will be carrying out in the coming months. So that's definitely something borrowers can follow as well.
Is there any precedent for the Supreme Court to look at in terms of evaluating this case? Are there other programs where a president has, forgiven loans or a lot of people would say, wait a second, what about, the loans that a lot of people got at the beginning of the pandemic? Those were forgiven. If Republicans in Congress can have their small, business loans forgiven because of the program, why can't students? Is there some equivalency there?
Yeah, so there is no direct equivalency to what President Joe Biden has enacted, which is this mass student debt cancellation. It'll impact millions of borrowers. And, the federal government hasn't really done anything quite like this. But the point you made with that Paycheck Protection Program that we saw during the pandemic is something that a lot of Democrats, even the White House, has pointed to. They're saying that, these staunch critics of debt relief, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, had their, PPP loans for given. But obviously, those are different programs. Those were, specifically geared toward pandemic relief, whereas this broad student debt relief is much more expansive, affecting millions and millions of people. So, regardless of the connections people are trying to making with these past programs and past federal relief, this isn't something that the administration has ever done, which is why it's being so hotly debated right now.
Now, the Supreme Court, of course, they're going to decide this based on the law. They're under interpretation of the Constitution, executive authority. But I'm also curious about the economic impact in all of this. And you, cover the economy for Insider. What would the economic impact be nationwide or in particular sectors of the economy if, in fact, the student loan program was upheld? And suddenly you have all these students who suddenly don't have to pay back $20,000. What does that mean?
Yeah, so at this point, the exact economic implications are unknown since this isn't something that hasn't been done before. But what the administration has frequently maintained is that canceling a student debt in connection with restarting payments won't really have a significant impact on, on the economy and on inflation. The idea is that those two policy measures will kind of interact with each other and cancel out any potential negative impacts toward inflation or toward GDP. And overall, it's something that they're saying it's worth it. It'll actually be a stimulant for the economy because it will allow borrowers who have been burdened with this debt for so long to actually make purchases, buy a house, buy a car, put that money back into the economy in ways that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise when they were paying off their student loans.
And have we seen a stimulative effect of the pause in student loans that exists to this day?
Yes, yeah, exactly. We have seen a pretty significant impact. Borrowers have been able to put money towards so much more than they would have been able to had they been making payments consistently.
Now, do you have any sense about how the court could rule on this? I suppose The options could be they just strike it down and say the law needs to be rewritten, or they say no, this is not legal under any circumstances. There's nothing you can do to sort of forgive student loans and make it pass muster with the Supreme Court. Are there a wide variety of options here, or is it pretty much either it's upheld or it's kicked away?
Right. So based on what we've seen right now, the Supreme Court is weighing a couple of questions when they're looking at these lawsuits. One is, of course, whether the plaintiffs who brought on these cases have standing, whether the arguments are actually valid that they can strike down this federal program. And the other questions that they're looking at is whether the authority the administration has put forth is actually something they can do. So if the Supreme Court ends up striking down this plan altogether, what they would probably be doing is just saying, sorry, you can't move forward using the HEROES Act. So that doesn't mean that federal debt relief is doomed forever. It ultimately means that the Biden administration will have to take a step back, think about how they can pursue a different route. But they would be effectively saying that the way Biden chose to go about it this time isn't legal.
It would also be humorous, I think, if it goes the other way. In other words, if the Supreme Court says, well, we're not going to rule on the legality of the student loan forgiveness, we're just going to say that these states did not have standing to bring this lawsuit. So too bad the program continues, or maybe it kicks it back. And maybe it's the two students that they get standing for their lawsuit because they didn't qualify for the $20,000 because of their income threshold. Maybe they get standing, but the states don't. It feels like it's almost like a Rubik's cube of different outcomes that could come here.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a ton of confusion that these lawsuits have brought, not only because of student loan borrowers who have been suing, but just because it's so unprecedented that a federal program to help millions could risk being struck down in a variety of ways.
And then for people who don't sort of follow the US Supreme Court, cases that are heard January, February usually get settled towards the beginning of the summertime. They're usually some of the last cases on the docket where we get opinions. So we might not know about this until the last few weeks in June or maybe the first week in July, right?
Yes, that's correct. And that's why payments probably won't resume until after June 30th.
Mm. You have a gut in terms of which way this is going to go?
That is the big question right now. I would just say, the Supreme Court is conservative. The lower court rulings have been conservative. So, I think if that gives borrowers any sense of where it would go, I think that's all we can really go off of right now.
It's probably unfair for me to ask credible reporters their opinion on how things will go. But let's assume you're covering the February 28th hearing. How will you determine what the headline is? Is it based on the questioning? Is it based on the where the justices seem to be going? Where does your headline come from on that day?
Yeah, I think that the questioning will be really indicative of where the conversation is headed. We've seen that in prior arguments that the Supreme Court has brought, where the questioning has been really, really fruitful, and it kind of shows where the justices are leaning in one way or the other. So I think that'll be really interesting to keep an eye on, especially how much they dig into both arguments on each side.
And it's going to be a fascinating argument at the Supreme Court on February 28th, and then even more intriguing to see what they do by perhaps the end of June on student loan forgiveness and the Biden administration's plan to forgive up to $20,000 for people who make up to $125,000 a year. Ayala Chefi, she's the senior economic reporter for Insider. Ayala, thanks for joining us and doing this. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. And that'll do it for this edition of The Conversation. On behalf of Asher Cofield, Gina Kim, Craig Lowry, Bart Kyle, and the entire team at The Young Turks, I'm David Schuster. Thanks for watching.